Overnight, the showers are expected to continue, and the low will be in the 20s and 30s. Also, keep in mind that we are still under a winter weather advisory that's in effect for the D.C. area until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. That's all for your headline news this hour. The news comes your way again at 3:55. Stay tuned now for Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer. I'm Darnia Samuels. Thank you for listening to WPFW Washington.
This is Pamela Brewer, and I'd like to introduce you to Brian Kenneth Swain. Brian is the author of several novels. He's a poet, and he's also an engineer and a businessman. That's not the kind of conversation that we often think about. Brian Kenneth Swain, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. It's a pleasure.
Well, I am delighted to talk with you, and we're going to start with just kind of going through your life, where you were born, what your early experiences were. So tell us, where were you born?
Wow. I am actually, although I live in Texas now, I was born in Maine. I was born in Brunswick, Maine, actually, which is on the coast in the southern part of Maine. Most people wouldn't have had cause to hear of that unless they were familiar with Bowdoin College, which is the one thing there that the people might know something about.
The one thing. So it doesn't sound like a huge area.
No, there's a fair bit of tourism and that sort of thing. You know, people go to Maine, they go to Booth Bay Harbor and places like that, which are all sort of nearby.
Okay.
But yeah, like I said, it's near the bottom part of the state, and it's pretty much right on the coast.
And tell us about the family you were born into. Brothers, sisters, mother, father?
Yeah, what's the best way to say this? I have two and a half sisters. I have a half-sister who lives in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Okay.
I have two sisters, one who lives in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and another who is actually close to where we grew up, right there in Maine, actually in Booth Bay Harbor, as it happens.
Okay. I don't think I've ever heard it described as two and a half, so maybe you got three.
Well, it's half when you have the same mother and a different father, I suppose, right? Is that a fair?
Maybe you got three sisters.
I can handle it.
Okay.
She would think of it that way.
Okay. And tell us about mother, father.
I grew up in a largely single parent home, with just my mom, the one who has an 80th birthday coming up. And she is out in Colorado as well. My dad was, very ill, his entire life. Mm. And was never at home. So even though he was alive until I was about 13, he was, for all practical purposes, he was not at home.
You know, that's a really interesting experience for someone to have, certainly as adults, you know, when you have a relationship of sorts with someone who's there and not really, there's a way to think about it. I wonder, as a child, how did you think about the fact that you had a dad, he was alive, he was there, but not really, through no fault of his own?
Yeah, it's I don't know. I've thought about that off and on over the years. And when you combine that, by the way, when you combine the no father at home with no brothers either, you're immediately led to, okay, well, this guy had no male sort of role models at all in his life growing up. And that's actually, in a way, true. Although there were a couple of fathers of friends and school colleagues that I had that, sort of filled that void in a way, although I'm pretty sure you'd agree it's not really the same as having having a father at home.
Well, it's not the same, certainly be impactful.
Yeah, I think so, and it's something I've actually written about off and on over the years as well, I suppose it's the kind of thing that I'll sort of noodle on and think about in one fashion or another for my entire life. But I do wonder, but I am sort of forced to wonder, perhaps even be a little bit envious of other guys I know who have brothers and who have fathers, alive or not, and all of that. So it's a little bit of a different situation.
Do you wonder how you would have been different? Do you have
of course.
Imaginings about how you would have been different?
I don't, you know, you can only speculate, but of course, yeah, I wonder about that all the time. How would things be different? I think it's pretty clear that I wouldn't be in the same place I am today, for better or for worse. So that in itself, I mean, you know, any major thing that's different about your life would land you someplace different.
Sure.
Now, right? So it's, you don't want to necessarily look at it regretfully,
right?
Assuming that you're happy where you are. But at the same time, it's impossible not to sort of wonder how would I be different? How would I feel about things? Everything from chosen vocation to education to friends to political beliefs, on and on and on. So,
absolutely.
You know, one of those things you'll never know, right?
It's one of the things you'll never know, but it certainly sort of reminds us that the existence of two parents is a powerful persuader, a powerful base, a powerful teaching opportunity for children. And when they're not there for whatever reason, that too, their absence is sometimes at least as powerful as their potential presence.
It is, and with one important difference though, and that is if I compare my situation to someone who grew up in a single family home where the other parent was simply never around, either because they weren't alive or they just simply vanished or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
It is a little bit different because in my case, as you say, he was, you know, very much alive. He was, you know, 2 hours away in a different location, and we would occasionally go and visit, you know, and see him from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But that was about the extent of it. But the fact that individual is in fact still around puts you in a somewhat different place than if you know they're simply gone and you've moved on and, you know, you're living your life without concerning yourself with that person at all.
Well, and you know, I think for some people it would put them in a bit of a limbo. Again, you know, that experience of, you know, the person is there but not really. Whether it's in a marriage with people where one partner is emotionally absent but physically present, or a family member who is physically absent and physically, I mean, whatever it is, that idea of, being there but not there is a complicated, and it's a powerful one, in folks' lives.
It is, absolutely. And, you know, coming back to the writing for a second, I mean, it has been a probably not only a formative thing just in terms of the way I think about things,
mm-hmm.
but actually in itself a source of, to put it crassly, a source of material. I mean, it's, you know, it's something I have written about from time to time in essays and poetry and
absolutely
and what have you. So,
well, speaking
yes,
of
that
writing,
in itself is not a bad thing.
No, it's just something I think we should all be aware of. But speaking of writing, as you were growing up, you were a little boy in a household of essentially all women, and then there was you. What do you think was your guidance, if there was any, to actually write? Did someone talk to you about writing, or was that something you naturally came to, or something else?
Well, it's sort of odd because no, I would not say that it was anything that sprang from either anyone in my household,
okay.
Or for that matter, anyone that I associated with socially, like I mentioned earlier, you know, the fathers of friends of mine or what
mm-hmm.
have you. To the extent that it came up at all, when I was in high school and all of that, you know, I do recall doing a fair bit of writing in the last couple of years of high school, a fair bit of poetry and so forth. Mercifully, all of that material is lost in antiquity.
Mm.
But I did do some of that. And then I went for a terrifically long time, really without doing much of anything. I mean, the whole time I was in college and the military and working for several years, I really didn't do much of anything on the writing side. And then all of a sudden, about 10, 12 years ago,
mm.
You know, something just clicked and I just sat down and opened up the computer and started doing stuff, and I've been doing it pretty regularly since then.
When you were writing in school as a young boy, as a young man, what What were some of the feelings that you had for your writing? Did you see it as a resource, as a challenge? Just what did it mean to you then?
I think it was, I think a lot of it sprang from the fact that I did have a teacher at that time who was very encouraging of that stuff. And I can't recall, I want to say it was either junior or senior year of high school, an English teacher who was pretty supportive of that. And of course, anytime you have that, it's a very helpful thing, right?
Absolutely.
But for me, it was probably more of a creative outlet than anything else. It wasn't, yeah, I mean, I was spending a fair bit of time because it was a single parent home and all of that. When I wasn't in school, I was largely, you know, working. That's a sort of a different topic. I started doing, actual compensated work at a very, very young age just because of how things were, partly because of our family situation, and partly because in that part of the country, it's just what you did. You got off from school and you went and you worked someplace for a few hours pretty much every day of the week.
Wow.
That sort of scenario is largely gone now, but it was pretty common back then. So I think the writing just helped, possibly as a, not a tension thing because it wasn't that bad, but just as a something different, kind of a way of, being expressive a little bit.
It sounds like it might have been a bit of a peaceful release that was yours and yours alone.
Yeah, I think so. And it wasn't like at that time, of course, very many people actually saw those things other than what you turned in for assignments like anybody else was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't as though I was trying to, publish anything. It certainly wasn't as though I was sharing that work with anybody that I knew or anything like that, unlike now.
Were you actively looking to keep your writing hidden very much just for you, or?
No, I don't think so. It wasn't in the sense of, not in the sense that somebody who, say, keeps a journal or a diary would do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really what I'm trying to say. I think it just was a natural thing that here's this thing that I'm doing and it's for me and it's in a binder, a notebook, and there really wasn't any normal cause for that kind of sharing with anybody else. There weren't any, for example, there weren't poetry readings that people went to and
gotcha.
all of that sort of thing like you can find now.
Did your family know that you were writing poetry?
You know, that is a good question, and I don't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to say largely no. And as an interesting historical little aside, I only discovered, I had grandparents on my mother's side growing up who were around for a fair bit. And I only discovered about 5 years ago, mind you, this is 40-ish years after my grandfather passed away, that I discovered in going through some old effects of my grandmother's that in fact, son of a gun, my grandfather, who I didn't know that much about, we saw him every couple of months because they lived a few hours away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, turns out he actually wrote some poetry.
Interesting.
And I found this out because I found a book in amongst all of their stuff that was, it's clearly written in his hand. And there are just like dozens and dozens of these things. And I never had the slightest clue growing up that this was going on. And I have no way of knowing, frankly, whether it was later in life that he was doing this,
sure.
or whether it was something that, he was doing ages ago and gave up or what. But I, based on what I knew about him as an individual, I never would have guessed in a million years that, that he was the sort of fellow that would do that.
Well, it sounds like a delightful, absolutely delightful find. But speaking of looking at him on the outside and never thinking in a million years that that's a guy who would be writing poetry, when we come back from the break, I'd like to talk about the person you are today, an engineer, an MBA. You don't think about those kind of pursuits as being the other side of a poet. So when we come back, we'll start with that. Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. I am talking with Brian Kenneth Swain, who is the author of several novels, several books. Secret Places is the name of one of his books of poetry. My America is another one. We'll be right back.
You're listening to listener-supported WPFW 89.3. FM, Washington, D.C.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you are continuing to listen to Mind Talk and a continuing conversation with Brian Kenneth Swain, who, as you heard me say earlier, is the author of several novels, short stories, essays, poetry, books of poetry, and an award-winning poet. And then on the other side is this engineer and business person. So, Brian, talk to us about that seeming huge flip. How do you function as a engineer and a business person, which seems to be all about logic, and creative writing, which seems to be all about emotion?
Yeah, it's a little schizophrenic, I suppose. Like I said, I started doing the writing about 10 or 12 years ago, and at that time I was working as a business person. In fact, I was still living in New Jersey at that time, and I've since moved south, and I spent quite a while in Houston doing similar kinds of work, and now in San Antonio. But on the one hand, I am able to use, because I come from a technical background, I spent a few years engineering, not too many, but I did go to engineering school, so I have several years of having done that academically. And that technical background actually shows up quite a lot, particularly in the fiction that I write. Mm. So the novels have definitely a little bit of a technological edge to them. And I think that if you come out of that sort of an educational background, it helps to make that sort of stuff more authentic and so forth. In the same way, for example, that Michael Crichton, who wrote all those Andromeda Strain and all mm-hmm. those other great sort of technological books, came out of Harvard Medical School. Okay. And even though he never practiced medicine, he was able to apply that background and that knowledge. And so I've sort of strived to do that on the fiction side. Now, that doesn't apply terribly much when it comes time to writing essays and poetry necessarily. But I think, it's just a different, it's a way to sort of unwind and put your mind in a different space mm-hmm. than where it is when you're trying to do something with engineering or spreadsheets or business types of things. They're just so different that it's a helpful way of, it works to the advantage in both directions, actually. Sort of shift gears and write and do some of that, then when it comes time to go back to the technical work, it's sort of a flushing exercise. That's not a very good analogy, but it really kind of clears your head and lets you function better in both spaces, I think. It's definitely different than, the people who come up strictly from the liberal arts tradition and they know they're going to be a writer from pretty much the day they hit college and that's largely what they do. It's a different mindset than that, yeah.
Absolutely. You said earlier that you began working at a very early age. Give us a sense of the various kinds of work experience that you've had over time. How old were you when you had your first job and what was it?
Well, just so long as the state of Maine doesn't hear this, but I actually started working for money when I was something like 8 years old.
Oh my goodness.
We're not talking about corporations. We're talking about doing, agricultural type of work where you get up early in the morning and you go out and you weed and you pick and you plant and you do things. And we had near our house, we had a couple of small, the type of farm where you grow a lot of fruits and vegetables and uh-huh. then you sell them in a roadside stand, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And so I worked pretty much nonstop for both of those individuals from the time I was eight and a half until, probably right up through 16, which at that time, and I guess still is sort of the first age where you can legally, go and actually work for real. But I did that, all of the time that I was in school. So pretty much every day was, spend your whatever 5, 6, 7 hours in school, and then go work for several more hours, either in the evening or depending on the season, very early in the morning, actually before school started. Mm-hmm. And that's not, in Maine at that time, and mind you, we're talking about the 60s here, Maine, of course, for a long time was a big potato place. Uh-huh. And particularly in northern Maine, it was very, very common for, in October when they harvested, for all of the children of any age, it didn't matter whether you were 5 or whether you were 15, you got yanked out of school for about 3 weeks in October, and worked full time, you know, harvesting potatoes. That was just how life was up there.
I'm curious, as you were so young and working, it sounds like fairly diligently, what kinds of ideas did you have about what you would do when you grew up? Was anything being formed during those early working years?
That's kind of hard to say. I knew at a pretty early age, for one thing, that I certainly wasn't going to spend my life living in Maine, first of all.
Okay.
The whole winter thing is, I'm not a fan of that.
But
as far as the actual type of work, you know, even in high school, I guess I knew I was better at certain things than others, and the things that I appeared to be better at were the math and the science and the physics and all of those things that sort of naturally lead you into engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for a variety of reasons, economic and other reasons, when I got out of high school, I did not go straight into college. I went straight into the military, into the Air Force. And so it was only after 6 years of that when I was getting out and I was 24, and instead enrolled in college and did that. So it was a little bit of a different trajectory than the standard high school, college, and go to work.
Sure. Did you have a job that particularly affected you in either a negative or a not so great kind of way?
Not really. I mean, I had sort of the standard, you know, kid high school type jobs. The one that's quite popular that I never did have, oddly enough, was the paper route.
Yes.
But I worked, I did the fast food thing, and I worked in a grocery store, you know, packing groceries and all of that stuff that you sometimes do when you're 15 or 16 years old. And that was really about it. I wouldn't say that any of those things were terribly formative, other than to the extent that it just begins to get you into the habit of feeling like working 9 to 5 and getting a paycheck is a sort of a normal thing, and that's what people are supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my first experience with that. And it was very different than the earlier one, you know, the getting up in the morning and working at night and doing the farming kind of stuff.
Sure.
So different experience there, but even those experiences, though, I should back up a little bit, that, you know, everything that you do when you write, mm-hmm. everything that you have done is grist for the mill, as they say, right? It's inevitably going to show up in an essay, in a poem, in a story, what have you. And in fact, several of the essays that I've written in that was now published 2 books ago deal with some of these very early life type of experiences. And in fact, there's one in there that talks specifically about all of this farming and agricultural mm-hmm. stuff and some of the specific, you know, fun little individual experiences that came out of that. So it's good material for other people to read about down the road.
You know, I'm glad you point that out, because so many times in life, as one gets to be, you know, in their 30s, 40s, certainly 50s and 60s, they can start to look at what they didn't do or did do in their lives that they regret. And the recognition that no matter what you did or didn't do, it is, quite frankly, grist for the mill. Whether you are a writer or not, you've learned some things, you've experienced some things that have guided you in one way or another. And that in and of itself has value. And I think a lot of times people don't remember that.
It's true. I mean, if you say, are there things that you regret? Yeah, on the one hand, but on the other hand, if some of the things that I perhaps wish had been different had in fact been different, then I would be in a different place now, right?
Exactly.
And so that's kind of the trade-off. So, would life have been different if I'd had 2 parents at home? Would life have been different if I had brothers instead of sisters? I have no doubt it would have. Would it have been better? That's a much more judgmental
Absolutely.
Thing that, as we said, we'll never know the answer to. But there's no question it would have been different.
Absolutely. Talk about the sort of the 9-to-5 world that you live in today, if there is a 9-to-5 world or 9-to-5-ish.
Well, there isn't so much now. There was until about 3 years ago, but now I am, since coming to San Antonio, I do a little bit more, call it free form. I do some consulting, and I do spend a lot of time doing writing and so forth, but I'm not doing the what I was doing in Houston, for example, you know, get up every morning, get in the car, drive to work, you know, drive home at night, that sort of thing. It's kind of different. You know, there may come a time in the near future when I do that again, but it's not what I've been about, for the past few years. It's got its pluses and minuses. I mean, of course it's, you know, it pays the bills. It's what almost everybody does. It's not what a lot of people do who find themselves, writing a large percentage of the time. Those individuals tend to be, teachers, they tend to be educators, they tend to be, or if they're really fortunate, they may very well be writing full time and actually making a living at that, although that is a, increasingly a very, very difficult, thing to achieve.
Absolutely. What areas do you consult in today?
Primarily, what I've been doing for the past, 15 or 20 years, and something involving, electric power. I started consulting back in 93, so 20 plus years ago, with, utilities and electric power providers and worked in that in consulting and then worked directly for one of those companies for several years in Houston. And so that's still my, sort of technical field.
Okay. So that's kind of what pays most of the bills and and you're doing what you know.
Yeah, exactly. Now, even in that case, as banal as that sounds, there, you know, even that and the corporate world in general, there's ample material there, to provide for the writing side. You know, like I said, we write about what we know, right?
That's absolutely,
you get told that by your first English teacher when you're in fourth grade or something. And you tend to, you know, that makes a lot of sense. On the other hand, you know, it is, for me at least, it's even more fun to frankly turn on its head and frequently write about what I don't know. And what that means is you end up spending a lot of time doing research and learning about new things and so forth. So for fiction, for me, the research and the learning part of the process, is almost as rewarding and as much fun as the, you know, when it comes time to actually sit down and write something.
You know, as you were talking about your consulting work, which is essentially, if I understand it correctly, working with utilities, is that accurate?
It is.
Okay. So that sounds like an opportunity to be really quite politically engaged, regardless of where you come down on the side of our American usage of utilities. Do you find yourself being pulled to write any politically driven material, or do you kind of stay away from that? Or is that not a pull for you?
It is definitely a pull. I do a fair bit of it online, but I don't do, I haven't done as much as, you know, you're sitting down writing op-ed pieces for newspapers and that sort of thing. I've done the occasional essay on that type of topic. And to be honest with you, politics in general, you know, is something that I find terrifically interesting. And in fact, one of the most fun things that I've ever done in my life, and I highly recommend it to everyone that I get a chance to talk to about it, is getting involved in a political campaign. I tell people it's something everybody ought to do at least once in their life, whether it's a town councilman or a senator or a mayor or whatever. You know, you'll never have a more energizing, fun experience. You won't make any money at it, but you'll learn a tremendous amount. And in my case, I was involved with one of the mayor's races in Houston several years back, and it was just a tremendous experience. I look forward to the next time I get a chance to do something like that. So it
sounds like life is very full for you.
It is. It's definitely keeps me busy, and it's changing every day, like anybody else. But I try to fill in. Like I said, I try to fill in all of the blank spaces with this with the writing, which is good because it's something you can, you know, depending on how you're wired personally, you can either do it, you know, sitting in front of a computer or sitting with a pad and a pencil. or even if you're out mowing the grass and you're noodling on a story or coming up with ideas while you're walking around doing nothing else. It's one of the few things that you can do, you know, while you're doing other things.
Absolutely.
So you can be fairly productive in that way.
And Brian, I learned about World Hunger as I was reading the Curled Up with a Good Book review that was written on this book. Tell us about World Hunger.
World Hunger is my first novel. It's now been, gosh, I'm going to say 7 or 8 years since that first came out, maybe a little less. Most of the fiction that I write starts with, you know, a simple kind of germ or kernel of an idea. So it starts in the form of what would happen if, and then fill in the rest of the sentence, right?
Okay.
So in this case, it was what would happen if a company that was a leader in agricultural life sciences or genetically, you know, enhanced organisms, you know, was creating new crop families and was field testing these things, and something terribly bad happened. And so that was the sort of the germ of the idea. And I mentioned earlier writing about things that you don't know about. And going into this project, while I've always been, or have been for a long time, very interested in GMOs, I certainly didn't come out of a biology space or molecular science or anything like that. And so I had to spend a fair bit of time educating myself, to a reasonable degree at least, on how these things work. And so the book is essentially about this company that is a GMO company that tests a variety of crops around in various places around the world, trying to come up with all of the various enhancements that you read about when you look into GMOs, whether it's crops that grow faster or more efficiently or in drier conditions or whatever, or that are more nutritious for one reason or another or what have you. And in this case, I take all sorts of interesting fictitious license, and it turns into something that is somewhat similar to what you would encounter if somebody like a Michael Crichton had told this story, which is to say that the insects that populate the areas around these test fields begin to actually ingest these crops, and bad things happen from that point on.
Brian, so for those who aren't, let me just interrupt you. For those who don't know, when you say GMO, what are you referring to?
Genetically modified organisms.
Okay.
Which are essentially crops that have been modified in some way, typically to enhance a single characteristic of how they grow. So there are GMOs that are, so for example, the very, very earliest GMO product that came around in the mid-80s was one that was designed to increase corn yields by exuding a sort of a natural pesticide so that pests would not destroy, you know, as high a percentage of these crops. And that was one of the first areas of research into this. Now, since then, people who work for these companies have developed products, rice, corn, wheat, that do all sorts of things ostensibly better than the natural varieties do. Now, this, of course, is a terrifically contentious subject at the moment and has been for a long time. And it becomes, you alluded to politics earlier, and this has become a very political topic. And there are people who are virulently anti-GMO, notably the Western Europeans, where this stuff is outright outlawed. And there are people who are very, very for this stuff, most notably, in countries where hunger is an issue, you know, the third world, the Indias of the world, and the Africas of the world, and all of that. So it is a topic that is fraught with contention, and it's sort of interesting. When this book came out, I did a number of interviews like this one, and invariably those conversations quickly turned from being about the book per se and turned into discussions about GMOs in general. And whether it was a call-in show or whatever, people had some very, very strongly held opinions about the technology. And what I tried to do in the book was to be, you know, it's not intended to be a pro or an anti-GMO story. It's intended to be present all the issues and be reasonably balanced about the subject and instead to just, you know, tell a fictitious story, which is ultimately the point of the thing.
And, you know, I was struck by part of the review was commentary where he said the book is well researched, containing both a bibliography and a glossary of terms, and the glossary contains only 18 entries. So don't fear, the writing is layperson friendly. So many times in books of this sort, not only do you need a glossary, but the glossary needs to be at least as long as the book sometimes. But you have developed a skill that doesn't require that. So the person can actually read it and enjoy it.
Well, that's the hope, of course. I mean, you know, and it's not as though there's an agenda here, you know, where the goal is, I hope somebody gets to the end of this book and feels a certain way,
mm-hmm.
pro or con, this sort of thing. What I would rather see happen is someone gets to the end of the book and they enjoyed a good story, and, oh, by the way, they got a little bit of an education into the technology that will make them want to go out and learn more. That's the hope. And frankly, that's the hope with all of the long fiction that I've done. I just finished the third novel, and all three of them share that. They all have some one or more streams of sort of technical content to them that hopefully will encourage the reader to say, wow, that's pretty interesting. I'd like to go out and learn some more of that. And whether it's about energy policy, which is kind of what the second book is about,
mm-hmm.
or frankly, whether it's about theology and art history in Rome, which is what the third book is about. In all of those cases, all three of those books have the same kinds of glossaries and references in the back that you referred to, and all for the same reason. To provide some resource
mm-hmm.
for the person who reads it and says, wow, that's fascinating. I would like to learn more about that.
Well, one of the things that I learned just from reading the review is that one of the modified crops that exists today is bananas.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that.
Yeah, actually, it is. It's pretty hard to find any crop now that is not in some way modified.
Okay.
You know, and we can walk down through the numbers, but the ones that really affect people, particularly in this country in their day-to-day lives, I would say more than any others, are corn and soybeans.
Mm.
Because you cannot find really hardly anything in a grocery store that does not have some corn product in it, whether it's raw corn, corn oil, corn starch, what have you. And the same thing for soy, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a hugely widespread type of thing. And for both of those crops, you know, the GMO penetration of those is well in excess of 90%. So in order to, if you decide tomorrow, you know, I want to have a GMO-free diet, I would submit to you that you would expend a tremendous amount of your time and energy making that happen.
Wow.
You would have to really put some serious effort into finding products that satisfy those that criterion.
Let me ask you this. As you're talking about this, and you know, I'm aware of sort of the feelings that are coming up for me as I hear you talking about the difficulty in finding non-GMO food. And you've talked about wanting people to learn and to be motivated. And you've also talked about when you've done shows about books like this that you've had very energetic responses from folks. Is this in general an angrier time in the world, do you think?
Oh God, yes. It's you know, depending on the topic, of course. You know, politics, you know, we're getting to a place in this country, and I don't think it's unique to this country, but this of course is what we see. You know, we're getting to a place in this country where, you know, there really are kind of two sides to things, right? You know, there's the left side and there's the right side. And there are plenty of people in the middle, yes. But the distributions and the opinions and the vocalness of the individuals on both sides has become so much more extreme in the past 50-ish years that it's very difficult to have conversations now. And it is much easier to sort of tune out to what the other people are saying and to sort of listen only to the opinions that reinforce the ones that you have already, and to watch the TV and listen to the radio and visit the internet sites that all reinforce the opinions that you have already, and to sort of convince yourself that those other people, you know, either they don't matter or they don't get it, or they're, you know, there's something wrong with them, right, or what have you. And GMOs is just one example that, that falls squarely into that category. You know, there are, you know, if you are, if you're perceived, you know, if you're an, quote, anti-GMO person, you know, you're conceived, you're perceived as a, you know, a leftist and an anti-corporate person and a tree hugger and all of these things. But if you're in favor of it, you're perceived as a, you know, some kind of right-wing corporate apologist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And none of those, none of the realities in those cases are as simple as that, but it's, but anytime you, you find yourself engaged, in a conversation about topics like that, that's frequently where you, you know, where you land. And I've even been in, I mentioned earlier, doing some interviews about world hunger. You know, a couple of the hosts of shows that I talked to clearly had agendas in one direction or another with respect to that topic. Mm. And you can tell when someone has an agenda when they start their question with, don't you agree that XYZ is the case? You know, and if the answer is, well, actually, no, I don't, or, you know, here's a nuance that maybe you didn't think about, then there's a tendency to sort of be dismissive of that kind of conversation.
And shorten that kind of interview sometimes.
Well, you know, you still have to have the conversation, because if you shut it down, then you're sort of engaging in the same behavior that the, you know, that the, that, that a lot of other folks are. So, I don't mind having conversations with people who virulently disagree with my point of view on things. It's part of how we learn things. But at the same time, it is very difficult to sometimes have a productive conversation and come away from it feeling like, you know, anybody learned anything or anybody accomplished anything.
Well, I mean, that's certainly true, and I certainly agree with you that in today's world, there just seems to be so much angry division. And maybe it was always there, and today it's just perhaps louder, often deadlier, but it is certainly there. Brian, would you happen to have anything nearby, like secret places? Would you happen to have that nearby?
I do indeed. In fact, I have a copy in my hand.
Well, this is a good thing. I'm going to ask you, and let me know when you're ready, just to take a look at secret places, and if there's something that you would like to share with us from that book, that would be delightful. I can tell you that I have a bit of a bias, but you are not required to respond to it. My friend Philippe, I thought, is a beautiful poem. By the Window is certainly lovely as well. But you've also written a poem called Witness Trees. I'm not sure where that is.
Not sure where that is either, to be honest. That's a relatively new one. I think I have that in a, I have it all in a binders, in a binder. I do have, so this is called My Friend Philip. How bad could things have been that a family's love could not assuage? How hopeless must it all have seemed that a late night call to a good friend could not have offered solace and perspective? How proud or afraid must you have felt to be unwilling to ask someone to come and sit and talk? I was 261 miles away. Is that so far? I would have come. You only had to call. I would have come. So that's that one, and it doesn't take too much perspective to get what that's about, I don't think.
Absolutely, and it's very sad. And there are people the world over who, while they have not written My Friend Philip, have certainly shared in the kind of pain that both Philip clearly was experiencing and in the kind of pain that the loved ones experienced who were left behind.
Yeah, well, and the funny thing about that, and not to get too maudlin here, but the Philip story, gosh, the Philip story, as I said, he was a good friend of mine when I was in the Air Force, and there's a story about people, you hear periodically about people who get near the end of their lives, and one of the things they do is they start giving away all of their stuff, right? Mm. And in this case, the painting that I mentioned that's hanging in my office is something that I had mentioned. We had been, I don't know, walking down the street or something, and I had made a passing comment about, you know, gee, that's great, or I like that, or something. And about 2 days later, you know, he had actually given that to me as a gift. And then literally not 24 hours later, you know, he was gone.
Oh,
so
no.
That was sort of, which is why I hang on to that.
That's actually stunning in terms of all of the emotion that would come up for you around that poem and that painting.
Yeah. And there are other ones like that. There's another one in the, you know, the unfortunate, these events that happen in everybody's lives that are less than pleasant. I mean, everybody has these, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the benefits of writing, I think, is to be able to sort of document how you feel about some of these.
Absolutely.
Things. There's another one, I think, that's in this same book. I can't even find it now. But there's another one about a good friend that I had who lived in Germany after he got out of the service. And who became very ill. You know, he and I exchanged letters pretty frequently, and he had a girlfriend who spoke only German, and I had learned some German in high school, although it was pitiful, to put it kindly. But when I visited him there a couple of times, you know, we would sit and talk and try to make ourselves understood to each other. But then my friend got ill, and I hadn't been over to visit in quite some time. And then one day I received a letter from the girlfriend explaining to me what had happened with the with my friend, and there's a
yes.
You know, that was another opportunity to actually write some things.
Yes,
I still have that letter that she sent me.
I do recall that poem. Tell us and I recognize that you're not able to put your finger on it right this moment. Tell us about My America. I think this is one of your favorite pieces.
My America is probably the favorite thing that I have ever done, and in the front of it, there is a very, about the briefest dedication you can possibly have in a book, and it simply says, to Rita.
Mm-hmm.
And without explanation, nobody would know what that meant. But what it means, it's a reference to Hurricane Rita, which happened in 2005, a few months after Katrina, which, of course, everybody knows about.
Right.
But people aren't nearly as familiar with Rita, which was almost as bad a storm, although it didn't go near New Orleans. It went up the Gulf Coast and toward Houston. And there was all sorts of projections of doom and gloom and so forth and so on. And so everybody was exhorted to leave Houston for a couple of days and go find some other safe place.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than actually go somewhere, you know, to a friend's house or what have you, what I did was I hopped in my car with some clothes and some food and so forth. And I actually spent about a week driving around more or less at random around the southeastern U.S. And instead of going on interstates, I went on little dinky back roads and visited a large number of just little tiny towns that no one would ever find accidentally, just mm-hmm. sort of, you know, if they were driving from point A to point B. And in each of those cases, when I visited these places, I sat down and I wrote short little poems about the place. And so when I got back from this trip, I had about probably 50 of these things.
Wow.
And I started assembling them into what turned into one very long poem. And then it occurred to me, well, it would be cool if there was something like this for every state in the country. And I have visited at one time or another, either because of consulting or because of the military or for whatever reason, I have actually been in every state in the U.S. at one time or another. And so I sat down and I wrote these short little poems about little municipalities, towns, villages, what have you, literally everywhere in the country, and they're all assembled into this one large poem called My America. And it's punctuated periodically with little epigraphs, little quotes from various well-known authors
mm-hmm.
who are from, so the book is broken up into geographical areas, so there's the Northeast and the Pacific Coast and that sort of thing. And each section is begun with a couple of quotes from individuals, writers who are originally from that part of the country. So that was the nut of the project. And like I said, it was a very fun thing to do. And in fact, it's occurred to me more than once that maybe someday down the road there'll be a newer, you know, longer version of this thing as I continue visiting places and talking to people. Because of course, this is the sort of thing that could could just go on endlessly.
Endlessly, and actually it could be a very interesting sort of documentary where you've got the visuals and the poetry together.
I haven't done anything with the visual side of it, but it's a great point. I think everything in here could lend itself. You know, if there was some photographer who wanted to go out there and shoot a bunch of neat artistic photos from little places all over the country, it would go very well with this.
And then I would think you would have a rather interesting coffee table kind of book. And actually, speaking of books, what is your thought about the future of actual physical books? Are they disappearing? Is there still a place for them?
You have another hour, because that's about how long that would take. The short version is, let me tell you an anecdote that I would have told you probably 2 years ago. And I had a conversation with a fellow named Jason Epstein, who used to be the managing editor at Random House. And he, you know, I heard a talk by him probably 15 years ago, and he was bemoaning the future of the book, you know, the paper, mm-hmm. ink and glue book, and everything was going to be electronic and on and on and on, all doom and gloom. And son of a gun, here we are in 2015, and books are still largely doing fine. But the anecdote is, I did a class presentation regarding world hunger with a high school, a preparatory school in Phoenix a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And it was about 100 kids, and it broken up into three classes, and I did Skype, answer questions, meet the author kind of stuff with them after they had read the book. And one of the things, and they all had to get a copy of the book. And they weren't told how to get a copy of the book, paperback, hardback, Kindle, whatever. And as an interesting little experiment, during these conversations, I asked them to raise their hands, which kind of book did you get? Mm-hmm. And I figured these are all 17 and 18-year-olds. They're all going to have e-books, right?
Right.
iPads, Kindles, whatever. Well, it turns out of these 100 or so high schoolers, something like 94 of them actually bought a physical copy of the book.
Wow.
And I was absolutely blown away when I saw that fact. And I didn't have the time to really probe too much into why that was, but I took that to be a data point that says, you know what, books aren't going anywhere for a while. It is a great thing that we have all these other options, because there are people who don't want the physical book. They want the e-book. They want the audio book or whatever it is. But it is just additional channels, if you like, additional ways of getting this material into the hands of what is ultimately a consumer, right? I was going to say reader, but not everybody is reading. And as long as the material gets out there, frankly, you know, I'm kind of a traditionalist, you know. I collect first editions. I've got a whole room full of them. I like the old books. I like what they smell like, you know, the whole thing. But, you know, not everybody is like that. Some people really just, you know, it doesn't fit into their day for them to sit in a chair and read a book. But if they can listen to it while they're driving in their car or whatever, then, you know, then that works. I mean, as long as the content gets out there, that's
the important
thing. So I don't think the book per se is going away anytime soon. In fact, you know, I'm one of those people who do a lot of self-published, print-on-demand, independent publishing type of work. And as that field has grown over the past, 10, 15 years, the number of books being made available in this country has absolutely soared. I mean, last year, something like 950,000 books were published,
wow.
new books were published in this country, which is a wonderful thing.
Absolutely.
The bad part about that is, if you are the writer, is you've got to come up with some way of cutting through all that noise to get your, you know, your voice out there, right? It's great that it's easier and there are more options for publishing, but it's more challenging, you know, in terms of how do you get this into the hands of the people that you ultimately would like to have read it.
Absolutely. Brian, it has been a delightful time with you today talking about your writing and your life. Brian, is there a website that you can direct people to?
There is. Very simple. www.briankennethswain.com.
And can you spell your name for us?
It's Brian, and then Kenneth in the normal way, and then Swain, Swain. Also, if you go on Amazon or Google or any of those sorts of sites and sorts of references to the books and the reviews.
Thank you for that, us today, and you keep writing. Thank you, WPFW 89.3 DC area. You can also view www.myndtalk.org. Here is Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. Thank you to Bernie Simpson, responsible for bringing one of our actual media coordinator. Thank you all for you daily as an educational public service, as a licensed medical or mental health professional. For more information about...
These are the headlines. I am Gloria Minot. A federal court ruled today that former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell will remain free while he appeals his corruption convictions. The 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond said McDonnell's appeal raises a substantial question of law or fact that could warrant reversal or a new trial. The court also ordered that briefs in the case be filed by March 2nd and set a May 12th hearing. McDonald's two-year prison term was set to begin February 9th after a jury last year found McDonald and his wife Maureen guilty of illegally accepting more than $165,000 in gifts and loans from wealthy vitamin entrepreneur Johnny Williams in exchange for promoting his products. Prosecutors originally sought a sentence of more than 10 years for McDonald, whose lawyers recommended 3 years of community service. A small drone flying low to the ground crashed onto the White House grounds before dawn today, triggering a major emergency response and raising fresh questions about security at the presidential mansion. A man later came forward to say he was responsible and didn't mean to fly it over the complex. The man contacted the Secret Service after reports of the crash spread in the media. The man told the agency that he had been flying the drone recreationally. He is a Washington resident and is cooperating with investigators. Although President Barack Obama was not at home, the security breach prompted a lockdown of the entire complex until officials could examine the drone. The White House later said it did not pose a threat. The President and First Lady Michelle Obama are traveling in India, but their daughters, Sasha and Malia, may have been at home. White House officials declined to comment on the daughters' whereabouts today. But ahead of the president's trip, aides had said the daughters would remain in Washington so as not to miss school. Still, the incident is likely to reinvigorate a long-running public debate about the use of commercial drones in U.S. skies as well as White House security. The Secret Service is still recovering after a string of breaches that raised questions about whether the president is adequately protected. House Oversight Committee Chair Jason Kafritz, a Republican from Utah, a chief critic of Secret Service leadership, said the agency has been working for some time to figure out how to deal with the threat posed by unmanned aircraft. He said a wake-up call came in 2013 when a camera drone crashed in front of German Chancellor Angela Merkel at a campaign event in Germany. Sleeper cells made up of former Iraqi police officers and soldiers are tipping off authorities to Islamic State group positions in the northern city of Mosul, a prominent lawmaker has told the Associated Press. The comments by Hakim al-Zamili, the head of Parliament's Security and Defense Committee, are the first high-ranking confirmation of the group's existence after weeks of rumors. Their work remains incredibly dangerous as the Islamic State group has shut down mobile phone networks and regularly kills suspected government collaborators. However, their intelligence could prove invaluable as the U.S.-led coalition steps up airstrikes around Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, to disrupt Islamic State group supply lines ahead of an expected operation later this year to take back the militant-held city. The punk rock band Dropkick Murphys is asking Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker to stop playing one of their songs, saying on Twitter, quote, "We literally hate you." Walker took to the stage Saturday at the Iowa Freedom Summit to its song "I'm Shipping to Boston." The band then tweeted at Walker's official personal and official accounts, "Please stop using our music in any way. We literally hate you. Love, Dropkick Murphys." The band has been vocally supportive of union rights and critical of Walker's steps to effectively end collective bargaining for public workers in Wisconsin. In 2012, the band also asked then-Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Jeff Fitzgerald not to play the song after he used it at the state GOP convention. Walker has continued to play John Mellencamp songs even after the rocker expressed displeasure. Up next from the vault, Margaret Sessa Hawkins has 4:55 p.m. headlines. Stay tuned for Live at 5. It's jazz with the, well, some jazz, right? Jazz City.